And at Willard Airport in Champaign, at the top of the hour, mostly cloudy skies, 89 degrees, the dew point 63, winds out of the west at 7 miles per hour. The humidity 42%, the barometric pressure 29.98 inches and holding steady. And outside our studios on Friends Plaza in Urbana, it's 87 degrees. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. A fire at a Chevron oil refinery near San Francisco will likely push up gasoline prices in the state of California. Now, that state has strict environmental rules that require a special blend of gas for motorists, so it's not really that simple to merely import gas from other states. NPR's Richard Gonzalez explains.
The Chevron Richmond refinery is one of the country's biggest, processing up to 240,000 barrels of crude oil every day. Officials have yet to determine the extent of the damage, but flames could be seen for miles away. And video of the fire already has had a psychological impact on the market, says Denton Sinquigrana, executive editor of the Oil Price Information Service.
Based on what we see in the wholesale market, you know, right now the California average is about $3.86 a gallon. I honestly would not be surprised if we saw, you know, a $4 average in California as soon as within the next week.
That would be an average price hike of 14 cents a gallon. Other analysts are predicting a hike of 30 cents a gallon. California has strict environmental rules that require a special blend of gas for motorists, so it's not as simple as merely importing gas from other states. Economist Christopher Thornburg of Beacon Economics says higher gas prices could be disruptive, but might also be a boost for more fuel-efficient vehicles.
So in other words, if the damage is extensive, you probably should go out and buy yourself a Prius dealership. If it's not, perhaps you want to stick with a Hummer one.
More than 200 local residents sought treatment at nearby hospitals for breathing problems. Chevron officials have apologized to the community for the fire. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
Chesapeake Energy is still a leader in America's fracking-fueled natural gas boom, but low natural gas prices are making that company less profitable. Now, Chesapeake Energy is selling some of its assets and shifting more of its efforts into oil and other energy sectors to try to boost its bottom line. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
After 23 consecutive years of touting its increasing natural gas production, Chesapeake Energy CEO Aubrey McClendon said this during a conference call with investors yesterday.
I hope you notice that we are now projecting a decline in Chesapeake's gas production of approximately 7% in 2013.
This is a big change for Chesapeake, which has been at the leading edge of natural gas drilling booms across the country. But prices have dropped to about $3 a thousand cubic feet. That's two-thirds less than natural gas was selling for 3 years ago. Such a steep decline has cut into Chesapeake's profits.
It's probably a fair thing to say that they're in some ways a victim of their own success.
Ken Medlock is an energy economist at Rice University. He says last winter, demand was down thanks to warmer-than-expected weather. At the same time, supply is growing, so over the past year, prices tumbled. Gas production is up because of controversial technologies like hydraulic fracturing. Fracking, as it's better known, has made it possible to extract gas from deep underground. But there's concern about fracking's effect on the environment. There are now some big names signed on as fracking opponents. Last month on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, Yoko Ono held a big Mother Earth globe while her son Sean Lennon sang.
So please don't frack my mother.
Don't frack me! Don't frack me!
Don't.
Creative activism is just one of the challenges Chesapeake Energy faces. The others are much less musical. In May, a shareholder backlash prompted Chesapeake's board of directors to strip Aubrey McClendon of his chairmanship, though he remains CEO. In June, the company said the Securities and Exchange Commission was investigating a compensation program for McClendon. And more recently, there were questions about whether Chesapeake colluded with another company to suppress land lease rates in Michigan. After years of fast growth, Chesapeake is making changes, says Ken Medlock at Rice University.
By being so aggressive and by really pushing an aggressive acquisition and drilling program, they've had to sort of reach outside themselves a little bit and seek some capital infusion.
The company is selling assets, including a pipeline division, for nearly $600 million, and Chesapeake says it will drill more for oil and other petroleum products that can bring in extra cash. But Chesapeake Energy likely will always be primarily a natural gas company. CEO Aubrey McClendon predicts better days ahead.
This has been a four-year down cycle and a lot of headwinds the last 4 years, but we think a multi-year up cycle is now underway.
Already, prices have started rising in recent weeks. McClendon says his company is set up to profit if that trend continues. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Closing ceremonies will take place Sunday at the London Olympics. Commentator Frank DeFord suggests that as we wave goodbye to swimmer Michael Phelps and his fellow Olympians, we also wave goodbye to the wave.
I always like it when Olympic champions from one sport go to another competition. So I was particularly touched to see Kobe Bryant with his children in tow, watching as the magnificent Michael Phelps bid adieu to his sport by winning yet one last gold. Phelps and Bryant are connected these days, too, because both have prompted some historical conversation. Kobe boasted that his current U.S. basketball squad could beat the sainted Dream Team of 92, while Phelps, simply by piling up more medals, opened up the barroom debate about who might be the greatest Olympian ever. Now, it's hard enough comparing teams and stars from different eras in the same sport, although I'm sorry, Kobe, but I'll take the team Michael Jordan is playing on, and the devil take the hindmost. But to try and distinguish between players in totally different sports is a fool's errand. Taking nothing away from Phelps' haul, but the record for most medals that he broke was held by a gymnast, which is another sport, like swimming, where medals are more promiscuously distributed. And before Phelps passed her, did anybody ever say that Larissa Latanina was the greatest Olympian? If not Phelps, Carl Lewis won track and field goal, emphasis on the and, too, track and field, sprints and long jump, in four different Olympics, and might have won in a fifth if Jimmy Carter hadn't made our first mistake on Afghanistan by banning our athletes from the Moscow Games. But Phelps and Lewis competed in marquee sports. Who's to say that someone most of us never heard of, like, say, Britain's Stephen Redgrave, who won the same event, coxless pairs, for five straight Olympics, isn't the best? Or must longevity be the defining standard? Does any cumulative achievement match what the Czech, Emil Zatopek, did in 1952 alone when he won the 5,000 meters, the 10,000, and, just because he had a free day, the marathon? What I say is, let's stand up and give the wave to all these candidates, and then, speaking of the wave, get rid of the wave. Aren't you sick of the wave? It's been around since the 1970s. It's not fun anymore, but it's mandatory to go along if some unoriginal idiot starts it up. Otherwise, you're not a good sport. Please. But here it is again, periodically at the Olympics. Even Prince William and Kate had to join in when some dimwit started it at the tennis matches. I was watching a Yankee game the other night when Donald Trump got caught in the wave. He grimaced and went through the motions, and, you know, I felt for him. And then I thought to myself, the day you sympathize with Donald Trump is the last straw. When the Olympics end, let us vow to wave goodbye to the wave.
The comments of Frank DeFord. He comes to us from NPR member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
And here is the writer's almanac for Wednesday, the 8th of August, 2012. It's the anniversary of the great train robbery, 1963. A Royal Mail train bound from Glasgow to London stopped before dawn by an unexpected red signal on the line. And when the conductor stopped the train to investigate, 15 men in ski masks armed with iron bars boarded the train and collected 124 sacks of banknotes worth well over £2 million. They went to a farmhouse about 30 miles away where they divided the money, but police were able to recover the fingerprints of all of them. 12 of the 15 captured and tried within 6 months, but shortly after the trial, two of them, Ronnie Biggs and Charlie Wilson, escaped prison, fled to Paris, had plastic surgery to change their appearance. The other three, including the mastermind Bruce Reynolds, also evaded the police for several years, but eventually all of the robbers were captured. It was on this date in 2000 the Confederate submarine H.L. Hunley was raised from the bottom of Charleston Harbor, where it had lain since February 1864. The Hunley was about 40 feet long. It was 4 feet in diameter, made of cast iron, propelled through the water by the means of a hand-cranked propeller. It carried a crew of 8, 7 to turn the propeller, 1 to steer. The Hunley was out to sink a Union warship, the Housatonic, which was guarding the entrance to Charleston Harbor. And it was successful. It launched a torpedo, and the Housatonic sank. But something happened to the Hunley, and it sank too. The wreck was found in 1995, about 100 yards from the wreck of the Housatonic. And on this date, it was brought up. And it was on this date in 1929, the dirigible, the Graf Zeppelin, took off from Lakehurst, New Jersey, on a round-the-world flight. The flight took just over 21 days. There were 61 passengers and crew on board, 60 men and one woman, Lady Grace Drummond Hay, a journalist who became the first woman to fly around the world. Before the Graf Zeppelin flew around the world, it had become the first commercial passenger ship to fly across the Atlantic Ocean. It flew a scientific mission over the North Pole, flew passengers back and forth across the Atlantic, but when its sister ship, the Hindenburg, went up in flames in 1937, the age of the giant dirigibles came to an end. Here's a poem for today by Maxine Cumin entitled In the Moment. Some days the pond wears a glaze of yellow pollen, some days it is clean swept. The trout leap up, feasting on insects. A modest size, it sits like a soup tureen in a surround of white pine, where Rosie, 14 pounds, some sort of rescued terrier, part bat, the ears, part anteater, the nose, shyly paddles in the shallows for salamanders, frogs, and